So now what we have are the people of God on the other side of the Red Sea. Their enemies are behind them. A sea separates them. Water separates them. The most powerful army of the day lies at the bottom of this sea. And it's all the doing of Yahweh, his rescue of them. But what we have next then is the move down to Mount Sinai. And this takes several weeks. I think about 3 weeks for them to get down to the traditional site. Again, we don't know precisely where Mount Sinai is either, but the traditional site is down here at the base of the Sinai Peninsula. This is a very rugged region, and so there are some things that happen along the way here, though, that are very significant. The first is that they are in the desert, and this is truly desert territory here, okay? Not much grows there. This is even probably a poor depiction in terms of the artwork because it's got cactus growing. There's hardly even any cactus will grow there, okay? And so how are these people going to survive? If, according to the numbers from the Book of Numbers, where you've got over 600,000 men of fighting age, 20 years or older, 600,000 of those, and then you multiply women, double that, and then children, you're probably talking of 2 million people at least, maybe 2 to 3 million people here. And how are they going to survive in the wilderness? Well, immediately God starts providing with manna, manna that comes from heaven, type for Christ. John 6 identifies that as well as a type of Christ, of God's provision from heaven of life. So these people live then through manna. And the word manna in the Hebrew simply means, what is it? Okay. They don't know what it is. This is new, but it's a gift from God. But the one thing that the people begin doing in earnest early on from this journey from the Red Sea down to Sinai is already complaining. Okay, they become wine experts, W-H-I-N-E. Whining about food, whining about their what they will drink. And God provides. He provides water from the rock here for them, and he is faithful to his promise to take care of them and give them life. Okay? It's also en route here to Sinai, even before getting to Sinai, that they have their first battle, okay, first conflict, military conflict, with another of the Semitic peoples. Okay? No longer the Egyptians, but now the with other Semites. This is in the case of the Amalekites. The Amalekites are descendants of Esau. Okay? So Esau, remember, was the other son of Isaac, brother of Jacob. And so the Amalekites, who are distant relatives of the Israelites, attack. And because of this, then, they will be part of what's called the ban. The ban will be God's call to remove people from the promised land. And that will include the Amalekites, because they, one of the reasons is because they do not welcome the Israelites here even at this place. The battle, however, is not won by the might of the Israelites, but through the Lord. And that is very evident in the fact that as long as Moses, who stands on outcropping over the battlefield, has his arms up, the Israelites prevail. But when his arms are down, the Amalekites prevail. Okay? Moses is 80 years old here, and so he needs assistance. Aaron and another gentleman by the name of Hur hold up his arms. And the arms here are almost a gesture that was a typical gesture of prayer and acknowledgement that God, you are God. We are dependent upon you. Once again, this message of dependency, this attitude of dependency on him. And so the Israelites prevail against the Amalekites through the power of the Lord. Ultimately, then, they get down to Mount Sinai here, the mountain of the Lord. And this is where God here once again reaffirms his covenant with them, okay? And yet he adds to the covenant. And it's a very significant addition to the covenant. And so oftentimes then this is referred to as the Sinaitic covenant or the covenant of Sinai. He makes an impression upon them, certainly through all the pyrotechnics and so forth that take place here. This mountain where he comes down to be present to connect with his people, and specifically with the representative of the people, Moses, is holy ground. And so, since God is a holy God and they are unholy, they are sinful, they cannot touch the mountain. And this will become a very, very significant concept now, heretofore, from the Sinaitic covenant. An affirmation of the holiness of God, and thus part of the ceremonial law and liturgical dynamics involved to affirm the holiness of God and our unholiness, and yet the desire of God to be among his people, to be present with his people. So that's the issue. How can a holy God make his presence among unholy people? And this is dramatically illustrated at Mount Sinai here as well. The cloud, the storm, the lightning, earthquake, all of those special effects, if you will, simply convey the awesome might and glory and holiness of God. He is not simply a chum. This covenant that we have with the great I Am is with the eternal, all-powerful Creator. And that is to be recognized here. Okay? Now, the covenant that is cut, then ratified at Sinai, is related to the original covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But there is further development of it. The covenant, as we've seen before, with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is one that is a covenant of divine commitment. Okay? And this is where God takes the initiative. Okay? It's his action, purely from himself, directed towards people. He takes the initiative, and in one sense, it is unconditional. He will see that it happens. And it's not bilateral, it's unilateral. And thus, in Genesis 15, he passes through that bloody aisle alone. Abraham doesn't do so. It's his commitment. And the promises associated are those three: the land, the offspring, and ultimately blessing to all nations. Okay? The second type of covenant is that of human obligation. Okay? And this is where not only does God make promises, but the people also must be obligated. And so you see the arrows here going to God and to one another, that there's obligation to one another and obligation to God as well. And this will be most clearly demonstrated in the law of Moses, the Ten Commandments, and so forth. Okay? So, characteristics of this human obligation covenant. It is a covenant, first of all, that is initiated by God. Okay? So that's always the case with covenants. It's initiated by God. It starts with him. We don't take the initiative and make the suggestion, hey, God, why don't we have a covenant here? Why don't we have a relationship? We don't come to God. He comes to us. As Jesus said, you did not choose me. I chose you. So the election is from him. Okay? It's based on the, it has its grounding, its foundation in the divine commitment covenant. Okay? So, God starts with the divine commitment covenant. Okay? And we've already seen that. But then, it's supplemented now, the human obligation, with the law code. Ten Commandments are the epitome of that, but the law codes, the thou shalt and thou shalt not. And that's what's received here at Mount Sinai, which obligates human beings. And in chapter 19 of Exodus, even before the giving of the Ten Commandments, and it's important for you to note that the Ten Commandments are found in Exodus chapter 20. Okay? You want to take note of that? Okay? Exodus chapter 20. The first giving of the Ten Commandments. There's a second giving of the Ten Commandments in the Scriptures. First of all, in Exodus 20. And secondly, in Deuteronomy 5. And you can think of that in terms of Deuteronomy. The word Deuteronomy means second law. So the second presentation of the law, so you get a second presentation of the Ten Commandments in Deuteronomy chapter 5. Okay? So, what you have here then in chapter 19 of Exodus is Israel at Mount Sinai. And notice what, how it begins here, verse 3. While Moses went up to God, the Lord called to him out of the mountain, saying, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the people of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Okay? So it always begins with God's gracious act, his initiative. I have saved you. I've brought you out as of on eagle's wings. I've delivered you. I've rescued you. Okay? Now, therefore, therefore, your response, calling for a response here, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel. So, treasured possession here. Even though all the earth is mine, he owns all peoples, but you will be a special people. And you will be to me a kingdom. So they will be the expression of the kingdom of God, God's rule on earth. And a kingdom of priests. Priests are those who are mediaries, intermediaries, representatives of God. So the whole nation will act as priests, intermediaries of God to the rest of the world. Remember to be blessings to the nations, to reflect God to the nations. This is also key to our understanding, which finds its most fullest fulfilling in the new covenant, that Christians are priests. Peter 2 verse 9 says that you are a royal priesthood. And Luther developed that in the doctrine of the priesthood of all believers. So a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, that is a nation set apart for God. And these are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel. Verse 7, so Moses came and called the elders of the people and set before them all these words that the Lord had commanded. All the people answered together and said, all that the Lord has spoken we will do. Okay, so they commit themselves to it. There's a human obligation to this. And so now in chapter 20, when you get to the Ten Commandments, you notice in verse 1 it says, God spoke all these words. It doesn't say commandments. It says all these words. And in fact, the technical term is not Ten Commandments, the one that's most frequently used in the Old Testament. But it is the 10 words or the 10 statements, Devarim. And many will affirm that, I mean, there's different kinds of numbering of the Ten Commandments. You may already recognize that. Lutherans number them different than those of the Reformed tradition. I don't want to go into all that. Maybe you covered that when you had your doctrine class and so forth. But the Jews number it differently, and they speak of the 10 words, and the first word is what you see in chapter 20. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. That's not a commandment at all. Okay? It's a word of gospel. Okay? So in one sense, we can say the first word that God speaks here is one of gospel, announcing what he has done to rescue them, to deliver them. Therefore, you shall have no other gods before me. And the use of the grammatical form here is not imperative for these commandments. It is imperfect, and so it has the sense of the consequence of this is you will respond in this way. This is how you will respond. And so it's this whole sense then of this is what I have done, therefore this is how you are to respond, by having no other gods before me, and then the rest of what we would understand as the commandments. Okay? And so Israel was to organize itself around the covenant of Sinai, specifically the commandments, the liturgical, ceremonial, sacrificial, sacramental, in many ways, provision that God gives at Mount Sinai, all under the kingship of God. That's the purpose. And again, the concept here is because God has done his saving act of redeeming his people, therefore we are to submit in this community to his lordship and his rule and obey. So it's a response that follows his initiative of salvation. The same is true for us as Christians. God's great saving work of deliverance through the suffering servant, Jesus Christ, his death, resurrection, the gift of the Holy Spirit. Because God has done that for us, we now respond. Seeking to do his will, to keep his law, okay, in response to what he has done for us. Not to earn his favor, not to be in his covenant. We don't earn that. We're already in his covenant by his activity, but in response to that. Therefore, this is how we are to behave. So again, because of the Exodus, we live according to God's will, humbly serving him and serving others in the kingdom of God. Because he has delivered us through the death, resurrection of Jesus Christ, we serve him and serve others according to his will, as is guided in his law. So the law for the Christian has a salutary effect. We talk about not only the second use of the law, which is the primary use, the mirror that shows us our sin, condemns us so that we might repent and depend on the grace of God, the gospel of God. But the law also serves as a guide. Now, in response to what God has done for us, we will seek to do his will. We never do it perfectly, and certainly the Israelites didn't do that as well, and that's why we give thanks that we live in grace and according to his mercy. But empowered by his grace and by his Spirit, we seek to do his will, which is his law. Okay? Another thing that happens up on the mountain, Sinai, that is very significant in Exodus, is the presentation of the design of the tabernacle, where Moses is given kind of the blueprints for the tabernacle. He sees the heavenly throne room, heavenly temple of God, and God says, go down and make a model of it on earth, and that will be the place where I will dwell on earth among my people. And we'll get into that later. Of course, when Moses comes down, what he discovers is that he's been up there 40 days, and they've become impatient, and they want some real tangible God. Hard to believe that after seeing what they saw and experiencing what they experienced, that they would turn back to idols, but they do. And they build the golden calf, and Moses comes down and destroys the original tablets of the law, demonstrating that they have broken his law already, even though in chapter 19 they had committed themselves to keep all the law of God. Already they've broken it. And so in another sense, the law shows us our helplessness to do God's will. Already they can't do it. But the Lord exerts punishment. Moses says, all those who are with me seek to worship the true God, come to my side. And the ones who come are the tribe of Levi. Okay, so the Levites, they come to his side. And he then directs the Levites to kill all the rebels, those who will not submit to the authority of the Lord, dominion of the Lord. And so there is the punishment, penalty of death that is administered through the Levites. And it's because the Levites are the ones at this point who are faithful, okay, who are zealous for the holiness of God and for his law, that they are now set apart as a special tribe. It's directly as a result of this that they are set apart as a special tribe to administer the holy things of the tabernacle, sacrifices and so forth. Okay, so this is the origin of the election of the Levites, the sons of Levi, for this. Okay, Moses goes back on Mount Sinai and brings down another set of the tablets of the commandments. And the commandments then are placed in a piece of furniture that God had designed and directed to be built, called the Ark of the Covenant, because it contains the covenant tablets, the two tablets of the law. We'll learn more about the Ark. Since Moses up on the mountain had also seen a vision of the throne room of God, and God had said, you go down and make a model of this, and here are the specifications of it, the tabernacle. Once Moses comes down, several months are spent building the tabernacle. And there's a lot of gold that must be used for the building of the tabernacle, that which is worthy of the worship of the holy God. Where does that gold come from? It comes from a free will offering of the people. Where did the people get the gold? They had been slaves. Okay? Egypt. Oftentimes this is called the plunder of the Egyptians. But the Egyptians gave, okay, they willingly gave. God directed the Israelites before they left Egypt to ask the Egyptians for gold and silver and so forth. And no doubt the Egyptians, who were pretty impressed with what they had seen God do here, working for these people, were so inclined, and that's part of the whole idea of God granted favor in their eyes, that they willingly handed over that. It's interesting that then the Israelites carry this on. We see it in the Law of Moses, that those who are servants, such as indentured servants, when they finally are released, the masters are to provide them with gifts and presents of gold and precious metals and so forth. So it's something that as you have received, so you now also give to those who come under similar circumstances to you. Okay, so the tabernacle is built through the collection of the people, and the book of Exodus then closes with the glory of God filling the tabernacle. Okay, glory of God coming to be among his people, presence of the people in the tabernacle, at the tabernacle. So that's how Exodus ends. Okay, Exodus also ends then still here at Mount Sinai. So most of the book of Exodus, okay, from chapters 19 to the end, and then all of Leviticus and a good portion of Numbers takes place here, and several months take place here at the base of Mount Sinai. A little more on the covenant at Sinai, specifically the tabernacle, because there is a lot of treatment of this in the exam. So I think these are the things that are important for you to know in the exam. And the description of the tabernacle in terms of the instructions to build it, the design that's given on Mount Sinai just to Moses as he's up on the mountain, the description there is provided us in chapters 25 through 31. Okay? But there's an interlude here because Moses then comes down from the mountain and discovers the apostasy of the people, the golden calf worship, and he destroys the tablets. And so you have the judgment that we described earlier at the hands of the Levites. Moses interceding, and this is something that we see regularly now in the book of Exodus and the book of Numbers. The people sin, and God threatens to wipe them out. He's had a belly full of them. And Moses intercedes. He's again a type of Christ here who intercedes on our behalf before the Father. And because of the intercession of Moses, God then honors that and grants mercy to them, spares them. We also see the renewal of the covenant then, starting over with the covenant with these people. And then in chapters 35 to 40, we have the actual building of the tabernacle at the base of Mount Sinai. Before they can move on now, the tabernacle must be built. And the precious metal is collected from the people. Okay, what we have here is the layout of the tabernacle. And for the quiz and for the exam, it's good for you to know the furnishings of the tabernacle and where they belong. There are essentially three categories, space categories, for the tabernacle. And this is the courtyard. So there was a fabric fence, if you will, that surrounded this courtyard, but it was open to the sky here. And then the tabernacle itself, obviously a tent that could be taken down. It was portable because these people are mobile. The tabernacle itself was divided up into two main rooms. You would enter through this way, this passageway here, and the first room, elongated room, is the holy place, okay, the holy place. The second room, innermost room, which was a square, was the Holy of Holies, or the most holy place. It's the way the Hebrew would say the most holy. Superlative is by saying Holy of Holies. Okay, so the most holy place, the innermost room. And this was all to depict, once again, these two main principles of the holiness of God, and yet his desire, and not just his desire, his actual carrying out his action of being present among his people. And this was to communicate to them those two main principles, that the tabernacle is in their midst and the camp would camp around. Okay, this is the next. You would have the people camped around, so the tabernacle would be in the middle of the camp where the people were. And there was a certain organization in terms of the tribes. They were organized according to the 12 tribes. The Levites would surround. They would have their camp surrounding the tabernacle. Remember now, they are the custodians of the holy things. Okay? And the Levites themselves were divided into clans. And the sons of Aaron, that clan, would be at the entryway to the courtyard. So they kind of guarded the entryway to the courtyard. But the point that is being made here is that the people of Israel are surrounding the tabernacle because the tabernacle is the place of God's presence among them. He's in the midst of them. He dwells among them because he is in covenant with them. Okay? But there also has to be a separation from them because of their sinfulness, because they are unholy. That separation needs to be made. And these various spatial categories signify kind of levels of separation. Okay? So outside the camp is where the people would be, the Levites out directly around, and then the other tribes. And only the priests, the sons of Aaron, could go in to do the priestly activities of mediating sacrifices and so forth. Okay? Now, the Levites could carry, when the tabernacle was in transport, the Levites could carry these other articles, even the Ark of the Covenant. But the priests were the ones, that is, the sons of Aaron, descendants of Aaron, were the only ones then who could actually do the priestly activities. The Aaron, the sons of Aaron, the descendants of Aaron, who are the priests, are Levites. Okay? So you have Levi, okay, one of the 12 sons of Jacob, 12 tribes. So you've got his descendants, okay, multiplying, and along comes Aaron. And within the tribe of Levi, then, his descendants, kind of a subset of that, are the priests. Yeah, Moses was a Levite. Miriam was a Levite. Okay? So you've got the sons of Aaron now who function as priests. Okay? What are the significance of these, again? They symbolize various, if you will, levels of holiness. So the priests could enter into the courtyard and carry out responsibilities. You had the altar of burnt offering. This is the place where the animals would be sacrificed and their bodies would be then burnt up as a sweet-smelling aroma to God. The laver, which was filled with water, and this would be for ritual cleansings. Okay, these two instruments were made of bronze. Okay, so out in the courtyard, the metal that was used was bronze. But when you get into the tabernacle proper, everything is made of gold. Okay, symbolizing the royalty of God. This is God's throne room, if you will. Okay, so it's his royalty. But really pretty simple furnishings here. You've got the table of showbread here, and there would be 12 loaves of bread that would be placed on that table. And these were called the table of the presence. And so these loaves represent the 12 tribes of Israel. So it's in a sense symbolizing here, God's people now come into the presence of God. They are given that privilege graciously by God to come into his presence. Okay. I think it was unleavened, yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Because leaven has an association with sin. So, thank you. Mm-hmm. The golden candlestick then was fueled by olive oil or some kind of oil, maybe animal oil as well, but later on olive oil. And it was then to illumine this room, because there are no windows here, and there is a curtain, a fabric doorway, so it illuminates the room, but it also then symbolizes the light of God's presence among his people. Because, again, this is the holy place. God's people are considered holy through the covenant, and their presence there in the table of the presence, the showbread, symbolizes that too, and they live in the light of the Lord. Okay, the glory of the Lord. And then you have the altar of incense, and incense symbolizes the prayers that rise up. And you notice that that altar is as close as possible to the divider into the Holy of Holies. And so the prayers, the worship goes before the throne of God, which will be the Ark of the Covenant is the throne of God. Okay? So the altar here then is a place where incense was placed, and that represented now the prayers of the people going up before God. So in this place, this is understood to represent God's people and how they live. They live in the holy presence of God. They are named holy, justified. They live in the light of God, and they offer up praise and worship to him. However, in this room, then, is the Holy of Holies, and this symbolized that, yes, God's people are holy in one sense, but they're, as we Lutherans say, saints and sinners at the same time. Simul justus et peccator, okay? Simultaneously holy and sinful. And so this represents the fact that in the purest sense, sinners cannot enter into the throne room of God. The Ark of the Covenant, then, is the throne of God. Later, the Shekinah glory will hover over that. The lid is called the mercy seat, so it's the seat where God administers his grace, his mercy upon people. And there was one rite annually in which the priest could enter into the Holy of Holies. We'll get to that shortly. Okay, here's another picture of the tabernacle as it might look from a bird's eye view with a cutaway. Okay, and again, this is all portable to be transported. Later, the temple is designed. This is Solomon's temple, according to a similar floor plan, okay, with the holy place and the most holy place here, the Ark of the Covenant. But what you have is multiple tables of showbread and multiple lamps. And the dimensions are increased. The laver and then the altar outside of the building itself. So here you have a depiction of the Ark of the Covenant. We don't know exactly what it looked like. It was covered with gold. It was essentially a chest that contained the tablets of the covenant, Ten Commandments, and also the Aaron's rod, okay, and a jar of manna. And so it represented here then God's provision through the manna, God's deliverance through Aaron's rod, and also God's ruling and guiding through his law. And some have seen representation of the Trinity there, of the Father who provides, the Son who delivers, and the Holy Spirit who writes God's law, his will, and carries it out in our hearts and through our lives. Okay? But it's also considered the throne of God, and the images of the cherubim here, the supreme angelic beings, most likely they were kind of sphinx-like creatures, depicted in the book of Revelation as the four living creatures, okay, are attendants to the throne of God. So this is the throne of God here. The table of showbread, or table of the bread of presence, again, 12 kind of tortillas, unleavened patties there, if you will. And then the lampstand, probably the tabernacle lampstand. This is more of the temple, looked different from that. Okay, so to understand the roles and the places of these pieces. Okay, now let's talk about Leviticus. And Leviticus, you can see the word Levi there. It primarily has to do with the responsibilities and the duties of the Levites, and the responsibilities of all of the people of God to Yahweh through the ministry and mediation of the Levites. Okay? And so it essentially covers these three areas: the ceremonial law, the civil law, and the moral law. Okay? So let's talk first of all about the ceremonial law. It describes different kinds of offerings and sacrifices. And there are five different types. We're not going to look into those or investigate those. You may study those in another class. Okay? But one thing that I think is important for us to realize is that these offerings are not simply, and sacrifices, simply people's gifts to God. But they are, in fact, God's gift to His people. Okay? And in fact, in, see if I can find it here in my notes. Yeah, in Leviticus chapter 17, verse 11, Leviticus chapter 17, verse 11, God says of these sacrifices, "I have given it to you to make atonement for yourselves." So, the provision of sacrifices is God's gift to His people to bring atonement, forgiveness to them. So, we as Lutherans will speak of the sacrifices as being Old Testament means of grace. Okay? Think almost of sacraments. Okay? Sacraments are the delivery places where God delivers His grace and forgiveness. In the New Testament, baptism, the Lord's Supper. In the Old Testament, one of the means of grace here was the sacrifices, and a primary means of grace for the provision of the forgiveness of sins. Okay? So, you should primarily think of the sacrifices as ways in which God provides the forgiveness of sins, delivery points for the forgiveness of sins, for the atonement of sins. Okay. Now, there are, again, different kinds of sacrifices or offerings, and not all of them had that association. Some of them are purely thank offerings that are expressions that we would call sacrificial, in which we sacrifice to God, offer up to God our sacrifices, are thanksgiving. But you also have to remember that there's primarily a downward motion for the sacrifices. God providing cleansing from sin, forgiveness of sin, atonement for sin. Okay? The foremost sacrifice is associated with the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. Okay? Yom Kippur, Hebrew for the Day of Atonement. This is in chapter 16. Okay, so it's important for you to know, first of all, that Yom Kippur is the preeminent offering, sacrifice, I should say, sacramental sacrifice of the Levitical ceremonial law, and that it's found and described in Leviticus chapter 16. Because we're pressed for time, we're not going to look at that right now, but it was the one time during the year in which the priest would enter into the Holy of Holies to bring the blood of the sacrifice into the Holy of Holies and sprinkle it on the Ark of the Covenant itself. And it was then the expression of God's forgiveness of his people, the atonement of his people through that sacrifice. There's a lot more detail to it that we just don't have time to go into. In terms of the ceremonial law also, Leviticus speaks of this law as established to guide people how to avoid becoming defiled or unclean. Okay, ceremonially defiled or unclean. For example, touching a dead body would cause you to be unclean. And the word for clean is kosher. Okay, so these are the kosher laws. And they're really kind of object lessons to help people think in terms of being clean or unclean, being holy or unholy. We no longer, in the New Covenant, observe kosher laws because Christ has fulfilled all of this ceremonial law. But for the people of the Old Testament here, these are established to help them keep before them this idea of their own uncleanness due to sin and the way that God makes them clean. So there, again, there's much more to go into it, but for the purposes of this particular course and for the exam, you just have to understand that Leviticus deals with this subject. And then thirdly, the observance of several Passovers, primarily in chapters, in chapter 23, these are described. There are seven festivals that are prescribed, holidays, holy days to be observed. And three of the most important, and certainly become most important in latter history of Israel and in the New Testament, are the festival of Passover, associated with the week-long Feast of Unleavened Bread. And we've already seen the origin of that at the time of the Exodus. The Feast of Weeks, which is 7 weeks after Passover. That's why it's called the Feast of Weeks, because you've got a week, 7 of weeks. 7 times 7, 49 days later is the Feast of Passover, of Pentecost. After Passover, you've got Pentecost. And Pentecost is actually Greek, meaning 50. So you've got, it's the day after 49. So the day after 7 times 7, you've got the 50th day is this Feast of Weeks. And this was a harvest festival in the springtime. Most of the harvest is grain, and so you'd have the winter crop, just as here in the United States in the bread basket in May and June, the harvest of wheat and barley and so forth. In this case, it would be wheat, so the harvest at that time. And then the Feast of Tabernacles, which is a reminder to the people of how they traveled through the wilderness in tents, how they lived dependent upon the Lord. And again, its emphasis is to remind you, you are always dependent upon the Lord. You are not independent. You are helpless, hopeless without him. You depend upon him just as the people did out in the desert, living in tents, tabernacles. Leviticus also deals with civil law because Israel is living in a theocracy. Yahweh is the king. And so in this theocracy of the where they're living as a society, as a civil society, law also has to be given to them in terms of how they live amongst one another in society, to to govern and keep order in their life together as a civil society. And these laws were both for the wilderness, but also looking ahead to when they settled in the promised land. And so their laws having to do with property, of agriculture and so forth, which would not relate specifically to the people when they're in the wilderness. They're not living in land with property and so forth, but it's looking ahead to that time. Okay, also, although Sabbath could also perhaps be considered part of ceremonial law, okay, it has civil associations in that it was to provide a time of rest for the people. And it was for everyone, in terms of young and old, male and female. In the community of the Israelites, there were foreigners. There were some Egyptians who threw in their lot with the Israelites and left with them. Other foreigners and so forth. You see that occasionally as you're reading through these passages. So any nationality was among the people here, they were to observe the Sabbath. Even animals were to rest at this time. Okay. And then there was also the rest for the land. Okay. So there was a time of fallow Sabbath. Every seventh year the land was to lie fallow. And then also in the year of Jubilee, okay, the land was to lie fallow. So the land could rest as well. Then there were laws in terms of penalty, and the capital punishment, the death penalty, was prescribed here, not just for murder, but also for other serious offenses, including adultery, okay, and, interestingly enough, contempt of authority. So, a rebellious child, a parent would have the right to see that a rebellious child was killed. You read that in the law here, okay? Now, it'd have to be pretty serious, of course, but or any kind of contempt of the appointed leaders, of priests, and so forth, that was punishable by death. So, civil law here, respect for authority. And then moral law, okay? Moral law. These were laws for what we would call the sanctified life, sanctified living. And specifically, in contrast to the living behavior of those in the land that they will soon occupy, those that they will dispossess, the Canaanites, okay? The perversions of the Canaanites. And the Canaanites, the Amorites, were extremely perverse. We'll look into some of that when we get into the discussion of the period of the judges. But you are to live a different life. You are to look different from the society around you. Still is true of us. Unfortunately, in many cases, Christians don't look much different from the general behavior of the culture around them. Okay? Especially the offenses have to do with those of a sexual nature, and chapter 18 spells these out. This is what Pastor Rossell calls the barf bag here. There are certain behaviors that make God barf, make him vomit, and specifically they're associated here with sexual perversions and sexual immorality. And as you can see, if you want to move down to the consequences, the toleration of these will lead to expulsion, and specifically in chapter 18 of Exodus, it says that the land will vomit you out. 18 of Leviticus, I'm sorry if I said Exodus. So, He says, do not make yourself unclean by any of these things, for by all these the nations I am driving out before you have become unclean, and the land became unclean, so that I punish its iniquity, and the land vomited out its inhabitants. But you shall keep my statutes and my rules, and do none of these abominations, either the native or the stranger who sojourns among you. Okay? Lest the land vomit you out when you make it unclean, as it vomited out the nation that was before you. So it's looking ahead, kind of the prophetic past tense being used here, when they take possession of the land and the Canaanites and Amorites and so forth are dispossessed. They're vomited out. For everyone who does any of these abominations, the persons who do them shall be cut off from among the people. Okay? So, toleration will lead to expulsion from the land. That's a part of the covenant here, that you will lose the privilege of the land. You'll be taken from the land, exiled from the land if you tolerate this. Okay, but there are other offenses as well. Again, the respect of authority, generosity, stealing, generosity means not showing generosity, failing to show generosity, not generosity being an offense. Now, about the Levites and the priests. Okay. The Levites, then, are that tribe that's descended from Levi. Moses was a Levite, and of course Aaron and Miriam, they're of the same family, so they are Levites. They were set apart at that golden calf incident because of their zeal for the righteousness, the holiness of God and His law. They are set apart now to mediate holiness and mediate the holy things. They then now become responsible for the holy items. They are the ones who carry the ark, transport the ark, they transport the tabernacle, and so forth. Okay. They are not given a distinct portion of land. Tomorrow, when we talk about the conquest, we'll see how the land is distributed to the various tribes, and each tribe gets its own allotment. But the Levites do not get a specific allotment of land because they are to minister to the whole people of Israel. So they are to be scattered throughout the whole territory and amongst the other tribes. Okay? The other 12 tribes, and you'd say, well, why 12? Why not? If you've got Levites ministering to the other 12, is that 13? Well, you've got Joseph divided up into two tribes. Okay? They're called half-tribes of Manasseh and Ephraim. And but they minister, the Levites now live among the other tribes, and they have specific cities, towns designated for the Levites in the territory of the other tribes. So they're distributed throughout the land. And they are then supported by the people's tithe, because the Levites now, in carrying out holy things, will need the support of the other people. So the other people tithe to support the livelihood of the Levites. The priests, as we said, are a subset of the Levites here. Not all Levites are priests. The priests are the sons of Aaron, descendants of Aaron. They are the ones who have access to the tabernacle for the carrying out of the cultic rituals, and they are the ones who conduct the sacrifices. Okay, so they are the ones who are the intermediaries in terms of the sacrificial actions, the sacraments, if you will, of the Old Testament. Let's move on here to the wilderness wanderings here. This is in the book of Numbers. The Hebrew title is Bamidbar, which means in the wilderness. That's the title in the Hebrew. reason why we call it numbers is the Greek Septuagint has the title arithmoi, numbers. And that's because of the census that we have at the beginning of the book, and then at the end of the book, another census. This will take place primarily after Sinai here, and will take place in this area here of wandering, and eventually end up just before crossing the Jordan River for the conquest by Joshua. Okay? So you have a census in Numbers chapters 1 to 4, and there's a census of warriors, all the males who are 20 years or older. There's over 600,000, I think 607,000. So what this is saying is, get ready now for the military battle, for the conquest. The intention now is to move from Sinai and go directly to the Promised Land and conquer it, to take control. And so there's a census for military purposes. How many military personnel do we have? The Levites are exempt from military service. So a census is taken of them as well. They will not fight, but they are to prepare then for their ministry. Okay? The Lord then guides his people in the wilderness through the pillar of cloud by day and the fire by night. So whenever that pillar starts moving, that's the symbol, the signal, I should say. The Lord is saying it's time for you to pack up camp, and we're on the way. We're on the move now. We also have then in the movement of the people the Aaronic benediction. And this is another important passage that you should note. Its source here in Numbers chapter 6. Okay? And this is again an expression of God's blessing, his intent to bless his people, the covenant blessing that is mediated through the chief mediator, the high priest. In this case, Aaron and his successors. It's called the Aaronic benediction, and you hear it regularly in worship. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious unto you. The Lord look upon you with his favor and give you his peace. And typically, the pastor in the benediction is holding up his hands. That was the gesture, as you can see here, for the Aaronic priest. Now, as Christians, then, we conjoin Old Testament and New Testament, because the hands raised for blessing, and then the sign of the cross, which is the source of blessing. But God's intent now is to bless his people on their journey. Okay? So they're making the move, and they get here to a place called Kadesh Barnea, right at the southern border of the Promised Land, and they're going to get ready for battle. And they send in 12 spies, one from each of the 12 tribes, to spy out the land in preparation for the conquest. And they come back, the spies do, saying, this is a wonderful land, it's rich, it's fertile. And they bring back some of the samples. It describes one case where they had to carry a cluster of grapes, two men, with a big stick between them, carrying the big cluster of grapes. It's a wonderful land. Okay, there's another symbol of that, them bringing it back. The problem is, though, 10 of the 12 spies say, we can't take it. We saw the people there. They've got huge fortified cities. No way we could overtake those cities. They are huge people. They're like giants. We're like grasshoppers compared to them. And so they don't trust the Lord. Remember, the Lord's the one who's won all the military battles already. They don't trust the Lord. And there's only two who say, we can do it. The Lord is faithful. The battle is the Lord's. Why are you hesitating? Do you know who the two were? Caleb and Joshua. Right, right. Well, this peeves the Lord, this lack of faith of the majority. And so the judgment befalls the people of Israel in terms of, because the people buy the recommendation of the majority. They become consumed with fear as well and say, why did you lead us out here to this hopeless situation? We could never defeat them. They start whining and complaining. So the judgment now is, and it goes back to that original census, God says, everybody who was signed up in that census that is 20 years and older will not get to see the promised land. They'll die off. And you're going to wander in the wilderness for 40 years, and all of those who are 20 years and older will die except Joshua and Caleb, their families. Okay? So they will see the promised land. All the rest won't. Those who are younger than 20 will be granted access into the promised land. By the way, once again, Moses has to intercede. God is so peeved that he's ready to wipe out the whole lot. Moses has to intercede, and God answers that. Oops. Shortly after this, then, we have another rebellion by Korah. Oftentimes, it's called Korah's Rebellion. It's especially over authority. Okay? The authority. And Korah wants a more democratic society. Okay? Who's this Moses think he is? Think he can rule the roost and dictate to us. We need a more representative government here. Okay? Let's flatten the organizational structure so that, you know, people like me can take charge, have opportunity. And especially regarding Aaron and his special status, that's not very democratic. So obviously I'm kind of paraphrasing here what happened. But it's a rebellion against God's appointed authority, and as a result then you have the judgment where the ground opens up, swallows them. I think about 270 are consumed here. And the people complain, God, how can you be so harsh? And so the Lord sends a plague and kills multiple thousands of people because of their continued complaining and whining. Yeah, right, right. Okay. Then there's another incident of their rebellion against authority, of Aaron's right to be the priest. And so each of those from the tribes are to bring a staff, a stick, and it's placed in the tabernacle, and whosoever stick then will grow and blossom, produce leaves and flowers, symbolizes that that's God's appointed representative. And lo and behold, it is Aaron. So Aaron is confirmed in that status. There's more situations where the people complain, and they need water. And so Moses asks the Lord, and the Lord says, speak to the rock, and it'll produce water. But Moses is in his indignation, takes his staff and beats the rock a couple of times. God, in his grace, still provides water, but he says, because you disobeyed me, you and Aaron, who seem to be in cahoots with this, will not see the promised land. So you will not be able to enter either the promised land. We have Aaron then dying, so he is not able to enter in the promised land. He dies and is buried outside of the promised land. And so you have this wilderness wandering. One last incident that we'll speak of before dismissing you here, and that has to do with the serpents. The people complain once again in the wilderness. This is, you know, an intolerable life that we have here. And so God says, well, I'll make it intolerable for you. And he sends these fiery, poisonous snakes. But again, he provides, upon Moses' intercession and mediation, an opportunity for their healing in this bronze serpent that's put up on a stick. And all who look to that then are delivered from the poison of the serpent bite. And this is another type of Christ. Jesus himself draws the connection in John 3. That just as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so the Son of Man must be lifted up so that he might draw all men to himself. Okay? So, eventually then what we have is, there's various stories, but we end up then at the end of those 40 years, at the threshold of entering into the land of promise, Canaan here, on the eastern side of the Jordan River, just about ready to cross over in conquest. Okay, well, that's a quick summary, but it's really what you need to know about the book of Numbers.